Chapter 10 Teaching as an Amusing Activity. There could not have been a safer bet when it began in 1969 than that Sesame Street would be embraced by children, parents, and educators. Children loved it because they were raised on television commercials, which they intuitively knew were the most carefully crafted entertainments on television. To those who had not yet been to school, even to those who had just started, the idea of being taught by a series of commercials did not seem peculiar, and that television should entertain them was taken as a matter of course. Parents embraced Sesame Street for several reasons, among them that it assuaged their guilt over the fact that they could not or would not restrict their children's access to television. Sesame Street appeared to justify allowing a 4- or 5-year-old to sit transfixed in front of a television screen for unnatural periods of time. Parents were eager to hope that television could teach their children something other than which breakfast cereal has the most crackle. At the same time, Sesame Street relieved them of the responsibility of teaching their preschool children how to read, no small matter in a culture where children are apt to be considered a nuisance. They could also plainly see that in spite of its faults, Sesame Street was entirely consonant with the prevailing spirit of America. Its use of cute puppets, celebrities, catchy tunes, and rapid-fire editing was certain to give pleasure to the children and would therefore serve as adequate preparation for their entry into a fun-loving culture. As for educators, they generally approved of Sesame Street, too. Contrary to common opinion, they are apt to find new methods congenial, especially if they are told that education can be accomplished more efficiently by means of the new techniques. That is why such ideas as teacher-proof textbooks, standardized tests, and now microcomputers have been welcomed into the classroom. Sesame Street appeared to be an imaginative aid in solving the growing problem of teaching Americans how to read, while at the same time encouraging children to love school. We now know that Sesame Street encourages children to love school only if school is like Sesame Street, which is to say, we now know that Sesame Street undermines what the traditional idea of schooling represents. Whereas a classroom is a place of social interaction, the space in front of a television set is a private preserve. Whereas in a classroom one may ask a teacher questions, one can ask nothing of a television screen. Whereas school is centered on the development of language, television demands attention to images. Whereas attending school is a legal requirement, watching television is an act of choice. Whereas in school one fails to attend to the teacher at the risk of punishment, no penalties exist for failing to attend to the television screen. Whereas to behave oneself in school means to observe rules of public decorum, television watching requires no such observances, has no concept of public decorum. Whereas in a classroom, fun is never more than a means to an end, on television it is the end in itself. Yet Sesame Street and its progeny, the Electric Company, are not to be blamed for laughing the traditional classroom out of existence. If the classroom now begins to seem a stale and flat environment for learning, the inventors of television itself are to blame, not the Children's Television Workshop. We can hardly expect those who want to make good television shows to concern themselves with what the classroom is for. They are concerned with what television is for. This does not mean that Sesame Street is not educational. It is, in fact, nothing but educational, in the sense that every television show is educational, just as reading a book, any kind of book, promotes a particular orientation toward learning, watching a television show does the same. The Little House on the Prairie, Cheers, and The Tonight Show are as effective as Sesame Street in promoting what might be called the television style of learning. And this style of learning is, by its nature, hostile to what has been called book learning or its handmaiden, school learning. If we are to blame Sesame Street for anything, it is for the pretense that it is any ally of the classroom. That, after all, has been its chief claim on foundation and public money. As a television show, and a good one, Sesame Street does not encourage children to love school or anything about school. It encourages them to love television. Moreover, it is important to add that whether or not Sesame Street teaches children their letters and numbers is entirely irrelevant. We may take as our guide here John Dewey's observation that the content of a lesson is the least important thing about learning. As he wrote in Experience and Education, perhaps the greatest of all pedagogical fallacies is the notion that a person learns only what he is studying at the time. Collateral learning in the way of formation of enduring attitudes may be and often is more important than the spelling lesson or lesson in geography or history, for these attitudes are fundamentally what count in the future. In other words, the most important thing one learns is always something about how one learns. As Dewey wrote in another place, we learn what we do. television educates by teaching children to do what television viewing requires of them, and that is as precisely remote from what a classroom requires of them as reading a book is from watching a stage show. Although one would not know it from consulting various recent proposals on how to mend the educational system, this point, that reading books and watching television differ entirely in what they imply about learning, is the primary educational issue in America today. America is, in fact, the leading case in point of what may be thought of as the third great crisis in Western education. The first occurred in the 5th century BC, when Athens underwent a change from an oral culture to an alphabet-writing culture. To understand what this meant, we must read Plato. The second occurred in the 16th century, when Europe underwent a radical transformation as a result of the printing press. To understand what this meant, we must read John Locke. The third is happening now, in America, as a result of the electronic revolution, particularly the invention of television. To understand what this means, we must read Marshall McLuhan. We face the rapid dissolution of the assumptions of an education organized around the slow-moving printed word, and the equally rapid emergence of a new education based on the speed-of-light electronic image. The classroom is, at the moment, still tied to the printed word, although that connection is rapidly weakening. Meanwhile, television forges ahead, making no concessions to its great technological predecessor, creating new conceptions of knowledge and how it is acquired. One is entirely justified in saying that the major educational enterprise now being undertaken in the United States is not happening in its classrooms, but in the home, in front of the television set, and under the jurisdiction not of school administrators and teachers, but of network executives and entertainers. I don't mean to imply that the situation is a result of a conspiracy, or even that those who control television want this responsibility. I mean only to say that, like the alphabet or the printing press, television has, by its power to control the time, attention, and cognitive habits of our youth, gained the power to control their education. This is why I think it accurate to call television a curriculum. As I understand the word, a curriculum is a specially constructed information system whose purpose is to influence, teach, train or cultivate the mind and character of youth. Television, of course, does exactly that, and does it relentlessly. In so doing, it competes successfully with the school curriculum, by which I mean it damn near obliterates it. Having devoted an earlier book, Teaching as a Conserving Activity, to a detailed examination of the antagonistic nature of the two curriculums, television and school, I will not burden the reader or myself with a repetition of that analysis. But I would like to recall two points that I feel I did not express forcefully enough in that book, and that happen to be central to this one. I refer first to the fact that television's principal contribution to educational philosophy is the idea that teaching and entertainment are inseparable. This entirely original conception is to be found nowhere in educational discourses, from Confucius to Plato to Cicero to Locke to John Dewey. In searching the literature of education, you will find it said by some that children will learn best when they are interested in what they are learning. You will find it said, Plato and Dewey emphasize this, that reason is best cultivated when it is rooted in robust emotional ground. You will even find some who say that learning is best facilitated by a loving and benign teacher. But no one has ever said or implied that significant learning is effectively, durably, and truthfully achieved when education is entertainment. Education philosophers have assumed that becoming acculturated is difficult because it necessarily involves the imposition of restraints. They have argued that there must be a sequence to learning, that perseverance and a certain measure of perspiration are indispensable, that individual pleasures must frequently be submerged in the interests of group cohesion, and that learning to be critical and to think conceptually and rigorously do not come easily to the young, but are hard-fought victories. Indeed, Cicero remarked that the purpose of education is to free the student from the tyranny of the present, which cannot be pleasurable for those, like the young, who are struggling hard to do the opposite, that is, accommodate themselves to the present. Television offers a delicious and, as I have said, original alternative to all of this. We might say that there are three commandments that form the philosophy of the education which television offers. The influence of these commandments is observable in every type of television programming, from Sesame Street to the documentaries of Nova and the National Geographic to Fantasy Island to MTV. The commandments are as follows. Thou shalt have no prerequisites. Every television program must be a complete package in itself. No previous knowledge is to be required. There must not be even a hint that learning is hierarchical, that it is an edifice constructed on a foundation. The learner must be allowed to enter at any point without prejudice. This is why you shall never hear or see a television program begin with the caution that if the viewer has not seen the previous programs, this one will be meaningless. Television is a non-graded curriculum and excludes no viewer for any reason at any time. In other words, in doing away with the idea of sequence and continuity in education, television undermines the idea that sequence and continuity have anything to do with thought itself. Thou shalt induce no perplexity. In television teaching, perplexity is a superhighway to low ratings. A perplexed learner is a learner who will turn to another station. This means that there must be nothing that has to be remembered, studied, applied, or, worst of all, endured. It is assumed that any information, story, or idea can be made immediately accessible, since the contentment, not the growth, of the learner is paramount. Thou shalt avoid exposition like the 10 plagues visited upon Egypt. Of all the enemies of television teaching, including continuity and perplexity, none is more formidable than exposition. Arguments, hypotheses, discussions, reasons, refutations, or any of the traditional instruments of reasoned discourse turn television into radio, or worse, third-rate printed matter. Thus, television teaching always takes the form of storytelling, conducted through dynamic images and supported by music. This is as characteristic of Star Trek as it is of Cosmos, of Different Strokes as of Sesame Street, of commercials as of Nova. Nothing will be taught on television that cannot be both visualized and placed in a theatrical context. The name we may properly give to an education without prerequisites, perplexity, and exposition is entertainment. And when one considers that save for sleeping, there is no activity that occupies more of an American youth's time than television viewing, we cannot avoid the conclusion that a massive reorientation toward learning is now taking place. Which leads to the second point I wish to emphasize. The consequences of this reorientation are to be observed not only in the decline of the potency of the classroom, but, paradoxically, in the refashioning of the classroom into a place where both teaching and learning are intended to be vastly amusing activities. I have already referred to the experiment in Philadelphia in which the classroom is reconstituted as a rock concert, but this is only the silliest example of an attempt to define education as a mode of entertainment. Teachers from primary grades through college are increasing the visual stimulation of their lessons, are reducing the amount of exposition their students must cope with, are relying less on reading and writing assignments, and are reluctantly concluding that the principal means by which student interest may be engaged is entertainment. With no difficulty, I could fill the remaining pages of this chapter with examples of teachers' efforts, in some instances unconscious, to make their classrooms into second-rate television shows. But I will rest my case with The Voyage of the Mimi, which may be taken as a synthesis, if not an apotheosis, of the new education. The Voyage of the Mimi is the name of an expensive science and mathematics project that has brought together some of the most prestigious institutions in the field of education. The United States Department of Education, the Bank Street College of Education, the Public Broadcasting System, and the publishing firm Holt, Reinhardt & Winston. The project was made possible by a $3.65 million grant from the Department of Education, which is always on the alert to put its money where the future is. And the future is The Voyage of the Mimi. To describe the project succinctly, I quote from 4 paragraphs in the New York Times of August 7, 1984. Organized around a 26-unit television series that depicts the adventures of a floating whale research laboratory, the project combines television viewing with lavishly illustrated books and computer games that simulate the way scientists and navigators work. The Voyage of the Mimi is built around 15-minute television programs that depict the adventures of 4 young people who accompany 2 scientists and a crusty sea captain on a voyage to monitor the behavior of humpback whales off the coast of Maine. The crew of the converted tuna trawler navigates the ship, tracks down the whales, and struggles to survive on an uninhabited island after a storm damages the ship's hull. Each dramatic episode is then followed by a 15-minute documentary on related themes. One such documentary involved a visit by one of the teenage actors to Ted Taylor, a nuclear physicist in Greenport, Long Island, who has devised a way of purifying seawater by freezing it. The television programs, which teachers are free to record off the air and use at their convenience, are supplemented by a series of books and computer exercises that pick up 4 academic themes that emerge naturally from the storyline: map and navigational skills, whales and their environment, ecological systems, and computer literacy. The television programs have been broadcast over PBS. The books and computer software have been provided by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, the educational expertise by the faculty of the Bank Street College. Thus, the voyage of the Mimi is not to be taken lightly. As Frank Withrow of the Department of Education remarked, we consider it the flagship of what we are doing. It is a model that others will begin to follow. Everyone involved in the project is enthusiastic, and extraordinary claims of its benefits come trippingly from their tongues. Janice Treby Richards of Holt Reinhardt and Winston asserts, research shows that learning increases when information is presented in a dramatic setting, and television can do this better than any other medium. Officials of the Department of Education claim that the appeal of integrating three media, television, print, and computers, lies in their potential for cultivating higher-order thinking skills. And Mr. Withrow is quoted as saying that projects like the Voyage of the Mimi could mean great financial savings, that in the long run, it is cheaper than anything else we do. Mr. Withrow also suggested that there are many ways of financing such projects. With Sesame Street, he said, it took 5 or 6 years, but eventually you can start bringing in the money with T-shirts and cookie jars. We may start thinking about what the Voyage of the Mimi signifies by recalling that the idea is far from original. What is here referred to as integrating three media, or a multimedia presentation, was once called audiovisual aids, used by teachers for years, usually for the modest purpose of enhancing student interest in the curriculum. Moreover, several years ago, the Office of Education, as the department was then called, supplied funds to WNET for a similarly designed project called Watch Your Mouth, a series of television dramatizations in which young people inclined to misuse the English language fumbled their way through a variety of social problems. Linguists and educators prepared lessons for teachers to use in conjunction with each program. The dramatizations were compelling, although not nearly as good as Welcome Back, Cotter, which had the unassailable advantage of John Travolta's charisma. But there exists no evidence that students who were required to view Watch Your Mouth increased their competence in the use of the English language. Indeed, since there is no shortage of mangled English on everyday commercial television, one wondered at the time why the United States government would have paid anyone to go to the trouble of producing additional ineptitudes as a source of classroom study. A videotape of any of David Susskind's programs would provide an English teacher with enough linguistic aberrations to fill a semester's worth of analysis. Nonetheless, the Department of Education has forged ahead, apparently in the belief that ample evidence, to quote Ms. Richards again, shows that learning increases when information is presented in a dramatic setting, and that television can do this better than any other medium. The most charitable response to this claim is that it is misleading. George Comstock and his associates have reviewed 2,800 studies on the general topic of television's influence on behavior, including cognitive processing, and are unable to point to persuasive evidence that learning increases when information is presented in a dramatic setting. Indeed, in studies conducted by Cohen and Salomon, Meringoff, Jacoby, Hoyer and Shaluga, Stopher, Frost and Reibolt, Stern, Wilson, Newman, Katz, Adoni and Parnas, and Gutter, quite the opposite conclusion is justified. Jacoby et al. Found, for example, that only 3.5% of viewers were able to answer successfully 12 true-false questions concerning 2 30-second segments of commercial television programs and advertisements. Stopher et al. Found in studying students' responses to a news program transmitted via television, radio, and print that print significantly increased correct responses to questions regarding the names of people and numbers contained in the material. Stern reported that 51% of viewers could not recall a single item of news a few minutes after viewing a news program on television. Wilson found that the average television viewer could retain only 20% of the information contained in a fictional televised news story. Katz et al. Found that 21% of television viewers could not recall any news items within 1 hour of broadcast. On the basis of his and other studies, Salomon has concluded that the meanings secured from television are more likely to be segmented, concrete, and less inferential, and those secured from reading have a higher likelihood of being better tied to one's stored knowledge and thus are more likely to be inferential. In other words, so far as many reputable studies are concerned, television viewing does not significantly increase learning, is inferior to and less likely than print to cultivate higher-order inferential thinking. But one must not make too much of the rhetoric of grantsmanship. We are all inclined to transform our hopes into tenuous claims when an important project is at stake. Besides, I have no doubts that Ms. Richards can direct us to several studies that lend support to her enthusiasm. The point is that if you want money for the redundant purpose of getting children to watch even more television than they already do, and dramatizations at that, you have to escalate the rhetoric to Herculean proportions. What is of greatest significance about the Voyage of the Mimi is that the content selected was obviously chosen because it is eminently televisable. Why are these students studying the behavior of humpback whales? How critical is it that the academic themes of navigational and map reading skills be learned? Navigational skills have never been considered an academic theme, and in fact seem singularly inappropriate for most students in big cities. Why has it been decided that whales and their environment is a subject of such compelling interest that an entire year's work should be given to it? I would suggest that The Voyage of the Mimi was conceived by someone's asking the question, what is television good for? Not, what is education good for? Television is good for dramatizations, shipwrecks, seafaring adventures, crusty old sea captains, and physicists being interviewed by actor celebrities. And that, of course, is what we have got in The Voyage of the Mimi. The fact that this adventure sitcom is accompanied by lavishly illustrated books and computer games only underscores that the television presentation controls the curriculum. The books whose pictures the students will scan and the computer games the students will play are dictated by the content of the television shows, not the other way around. Books, it would appear, have now become an audiovisual aid. The principal carrier of the content of education is the television show, and its principal claim for a preeminent place in the curriculum is that it is entertaining. Of course, a television production can be used to stimulate interest in lessons, or even as the focal point of a lesson. But what is happening here is that the content of the school curriculum is being determined by the character of television. And even worse, that character is apparently not included as part of what is studied. One would have thought that the schoolroom is the proper place for students to inquire into the ways in which media of all kinds, including television, shape people's attitudes and perceptions. Since our students will have watched approximately 16,000 hours of television by high school's end, questions should have arisen, even in the minds of officials at the Department of Education, about who will teach our students how to look at television and when not to, and with what critical equipment when they do. The Voyage of the Mimi project bypasses these questions, indeed, hopes that the students will immerse themselves in the dramatizations in the same frame of mind used when watching St. Elsewhere or Hill Street Blues. One may also assume that what is called computer literacy does not involve raising questions about the cognitive biases and social effects of the computer, which, I would venture, are the most important questions to address about new technologies. The Voyage of the Mimi, in other words, spent $3.65 million for the purpose of using media in exactly the manner that media merchants want them to be used, mindlessly and invisibly, as if media themselves have no epistemological or political agenda. And in the end, what will the students have learned? They will, to be sure, have learned something about whales, perhaps about navigation and map reading, most of which they could have learned just as well by other means. Mainly, they will have learned that learning is a form of entertainment, or, more precisely, that anything worth learning can take the form of an entertainment and ought to. And they will not rebel if their English teacher asks them to learn the 8 parts of speech through the medium of rock music, or if their social studies teacher sings to them the facts about the War of 1812, or if their physics comes to them on cookies and T-shirts. Indeed, they will expect it, and thus will be well prepared to receive their politics, their religion, their news, and their commerce in the same delightful way.